Depending on how you define it, the public sector spends between a third of a trillion and £1 trillion a year. Yet public sector procurement isn't exactly a byword for innovation. This is the week that the new Procurement Act goes live, supposed to make all this easier. So let's talk to Rakesh Shah of the Innovation Procurement Empowerment Centre to find out what the problem is, how to fix it, and whether the new Act will actually help. Welcome to Freewheeling, the free-thinking podcast about moving forward faster. My name's Thomas Abelman, and each week I'll bring you fresh voices, new ideas, and unconventional thinking. So let's get started now with this week's edition of the Freewheeling podcast. My guest this week is a former colleague. Hello, Rakesh.
Hello, Thomas. How are you?
I'm very well indeed. So we first met at TFL. We used to work together. And when I was Director of Strategy and Innovation, you were Head of Open Innovation, and we tried to do great things together in Transport for London.
Absolutely. It was a great time.
And I've recognised the wall behind you, and we have actually both left, but you seem to have rebounded because you're talking to me from TFL's HQ. I seem to.
Yeah, they've kindly let me in today. I'm still involved with the London Transport Museum as a non-executive director, so I'm doing some work with them today. So it's nice to be back here.
Fantastic. Now, I'm talking to you, and I promise this is going to be interesting because it's going to sound really dull, but I promise Rakesh is going to make this interesting because we're talking together because the new Procurement Act comes into force this month. And I just want to give my listeners some context here. So like me, you've also left TFL. And like me, you've also set up a new organisation, though yours is in the public sector, and you're now head of the Innovation Procurement Empowerment Centre. Tell me about the Innovation Procurement Empowerment Centre.
Yeah, so the Innovation Procurement Empowerment Centre is all about empowerment. So it's funded through government funding via Innovate UK, and it's there to empower the public sector to better use procurement budgets to diversify its supply chain and solve those knotty problems. So what I mean by this, to give it more context, is the public sector spends over £300 billion a year in the UK. And despite the spend, we've got lots of challenges that are really knotty challenges. So it could be around climate change, it could be around resilience, it could be around health, housing, that list goes on. So when we have those knotty problem statements, sometimes we try and solve everything ourselves in the public sector. Or if we can't solve it ourselves, we might go to the market and overprescribe what we want. But instead, what we're saying is, with advances in technology, there are so many good ideas out there that comes from the market. And as a result, how can IPEC help public buyers and innovators in the public sector to better unlock more value by working with those diverse supply chains? And we've got lots of different things going on, which I'm sure we'll talk about in a second.
So one of the things I love about you and always loved about you when we worked together was your ambition. But just reinforcing the scope here, you have set up an organisation designed to empower the public sector, which is 6 million people spending £1 trillion. I mean, you said 300 billion, but the entire public sector I calculated as a trillion. That's quite a big scope you've set for yourself there.
Yeah, and I think we won't solve everything, but certainly there's a couple of things that we can do. We can make a difference, even if it was a percent or a 2% or a 5%. That's still billions of pounds worth of value that we can create. I think it's certainly not IPEC that's trying to do that. What IPEC's trying to do is create the tools, build the communities, do the upskilling, but help to normalize and tell those stories that actually bringing innovation into the public sector and doing things better, cheaper and quicker, it can be done by diversifying your supply chain. And whether that's a startup or a scale-up or a large corporate or an academic spin-out, how do you be more vulnerable by sharing those knotty problems with the market and let the market come back with ideas that can bring new thinking, new value, and ultimately deliver better outcomes for a particular local or central or regional agency?
Well, you've already said two words that are so important when it comes to achieving innovation, haven't you? One of which is empowerment and one of which is vulnerability. And they're things that we find surprisingly difficult, surprisingly hard to let people simply try things, and surprisingly hard to admit we don't know the answers and we need to try and find out the answers, fill in our own knowledge gaps.
Completely. And I think if we think about what, you know, some of the things that we've been involved with around open innovation, a lot of it is around being entrepreneurial. And it's about creating shared value to achieve those better outcomes. And I think that means that there's a reset around how we work with the market, because we need to move away from those transactional relationships. And to be fair, if you're buying chairs, you're buying cloud, that might be more transactional. because you know exactly what you want. And maybe the opportunity for innovation there is limited. But if it's a problem that you're stuck on, if you're going to the market with a very prescribed solution, the market rightfully will be coming back to you and saying, we can do that because we want to win your business. But there are different ways that we can address your problem. And I think it's how do we set those outcome-based specifications in a very mission-focused manner, which is what the current government's talking about, to address those challenges. And that requires being more experimental, being more open, being iterative, and hopefully creating the right mechanisms to scale those solutions.
So you're not, by background, a procurement person, and you're now leading an organization that has set itself to the mission of helping the entire public sector solve its procurement challenges, which, my Lord, is desperately needed. And I know from our TfL days together how and why you got into procurement as a key enabler for innovation. But tell my listeners the story of your journey into the tangled world of public sector procurement.
Yeah, sure. So I think a lot of this started from my open data days. So Transport for London releases its data, some of its data, and shares that with the market. And then what we found when we did that, the likes of Citymapper, Google Maps, Apple Maps, Mapway, and many others were creating products. In fact, we had 700 products out there developed by the market to provide information to Londoners, and 42% of Londoners were accessing that data powered by TfL. And at its peak, we had over 17,000 developers. So let me just set the scene. 17,000 developers are trying to solve some of the challenges that we have in London just through data. And that value that we created was worth £130 million per annum. So if we could do that with data, why can't that be a way of working with the market? And that's where we set up a function called commercial innovation, which ended up becoming open innovation. And my job there was, how can we better work with the market in a shared value manner, whether it's a large corporate or a startup or anyone else in between, and to realize value? And very quickly, we realized rather than doing closed innovation, which has a significant cost already up front, why can't we focus on open innovation, which is sharing those problems to the market and see what it comes back with? But then there are problems. Lots of good ideas came through, but how do you actually scale them? And that's where procurement comes in. That's where you start working with procurement to say, before even I take a problem on board, what's the route to market? What's the route to scale? And I remember having conversations with colleagues in the past where we'd have a workshop and I'd set out 20 different scenarios where I'd say procurement seems like perceived barrier. And I would say to the procurement colleagues, how do I make this work? How do I scale it? And I remember sitting down with our general counsel team at the time, and they were looking at me strangely to say, Rikesh, most of the procurements, we know what we want. And I said, in this case, I don't. So they came back to me after 12 hours of workshops. So 4 sessions, 3 hours each with all these scenarios. And they said, Rikesh, we think we know what you want. You want to procure something, but you don't know what it is, but you know what outcome you want. And I said, I can go with that. So then suddenly we started to learn about innovative partnership procedures, R&D exemptions, many other procurement processes. And that's where my interest started. One thing I would say up front is procurement's not a barrier, because what I found, once the procurement colleagues knew what I wanted and I shared with them up front what the challenges were, they found routes to market. Then it comes into the other barrier. And the other barrier is culture. And culture is a big challenge in the public sector when it comes to fear of failure. You know, if you're doing something new and different, you have to report to the politicians. You have to report to the media. You have to report to other key stakeholders. And suddenly, when you're procuring something that you don't know what it is, how do you sell that up front and avoid? It's inevitable. If you're pushing boundaries, things will go wrong. So then you start moving into another challenge, which I'm sure we'll talk about, is culture. That's how I got into procurement. And then I needed the right procurement colleagues, which again, we can talk about in a second.
The cultural piece around fear of failure is so important. But right at the start of this journey, you almost skipped over one of the other cultural barriers, which absolutely exists, which is this one of accepting that the outside world might have solutions to the problems that you as a public sector organization have. Because as you know, and I know one of the problems you've tried to overcome and you were doing a great job in TfL of overcoming and are now trying to help many more organizations overcome, is this perception that, being honest, large chunks of the public sector have private companies are all rapacious, money-grabbing bastards trying to steal from the public sector. And the best thing we can do is keep them at a very long arm's length, tell them exactly what we want and beat them with sticks if they don't deliver it. And as you say, if you're buying paperclips, that's not necessarily, well, I'm not saying paperclip suppliers are money-grabbing bastards, but that's not necessarily an unwise way of buying. But it makes it very, very hard to build collaborative partnerships and co-create solutions.
Completely. And this, yeah, that's where I think it's not just a procurement challenge, and I'm not having a go at procurement colleagues here. It's much, much broader, which is, A, as I mentioned earlier, that vulnerability, which is actually we're stuck on something. We need to go to the market. Because otherwise, in a closed innovation manner, what we're doing is we're throwing six or seven bodies to try and solve a particular problem. And there's incredible bias in there. Whereas if we had those same colleagues from different parts of an organization saying to the market, what types of ideas are there? Now, arguably, you can call that in a procurement language, pre-market engagement. You know, you're at a very early stage saying, what's out there? You know, whether it's AI related, because that seems to be the words of the month, whether it's robotics, whether it's quantum or some other form of new technology. How do I understand what's out there? And then how do I prove it that it works or it doesn't work? And I think that's where I think procurement colleagues in particular, as they start shaping pipelines, need to challenge the business area a bit more and say, we need to build some more intelligence around what's out there, what type of suppliers are out there, and then experiment. So when actually we write that specification, it can be as good as it possibly can be in terms of creating value, as opposed to sometimes us buying the same old stuff.
Yeah, and we've both seen that, and I'm not going to quote examples, but literally you and I have both seen that, of a specification that is what we bought last time, and last time was 10 years ago, and the world has transformed in that 10 years, technology has transformed in that year, in that time, but literally suppliers have to remove capability from their product in order to issue a compliant bid to that specification, which kind of feels like madness. But you can also see how it happens. Someone says, I want to keep buying the service. Okay, well, let's just issue the specification we had last time, but it misses all of the opportunity for innovation, change, growth, improvement. What kinds of solutions are you seeing in IPEC to solve these cultural challenges and these behavioral challenges? Because we're going to come on to the Procurement Act in a minute, which is the government's attempt to solve some of these problems or to provide enablers to some of these solutions. But what kinds of things are you working on?
Yeah, and I think one other point I'll make on the previous point that you made, which is really valid, is the public sector is a market shaper. Yeah, it's by the budgets that we have in the public sector, we can shape markets in very different ways that creates even more value because you've got so many different buyers. So answering your question on IPEC, we're seeing a wide range of things and lots of good practice. So I'll talk a little bit about some of the services that we're offering to public authorities across the UK. So we're running fully funded cohort programs, which we're working with local authorities in particular, because what I've also realized is there are some very small local authorities that have significant challenges, really serious challenges, where some services may be closing down. And we're seeing local authorities close to bankruptcy in many cases. So we have to create this value. Through the cohort program that we've run recently, we worked with Bristol City Council, Westminster City Council, Newham and Derry City Council. And they all had very different challenges. One was focused on sustainability and one was focused on housing and retrofitting. There was another one focused on freight and reducing the adverse impact of freight. And there was another one that was with Westminster that was focused on reducing particulate matter 2.5 as a result of cooking oil. And with all of them, we went out to the market and we saw lots of different ideas. And I'm delighted to say with Westminster, they've just awarded a contract to address some of the challenges around cooking oil. Now, it may work, it may not work, but we've designed a procurement that runs an end-to-end process that allows you to test, experiment, and then potentially scale if the idea is working.
And this is really unusual, isn't it? I mean, I was talking to a public sector, a very senior director in a public sector organisation, actually not in transport, today, who was saying that across the board, they face the problem that you can pilot something and you can pilot lots of things and you can buy scale solutions, but you find it almost impossible to buy the scale version of the thing that you piloted. And she gave me an example of a project where, you know, they piloted something, they knew exactly what they needed, it was the only service that provided it, but then when they tried to scale it up, what they ended up with was a completely different service from a completely different provider that didn't actually do the thing that they had wanted. But that was kind of where the procurement machinery had landed them.
Yeah.
Do you think that the solutions do exist already to this problem? It's just that people don't know that they're there. And is that what you can help them with? Or is it actually the rules? The rules is the rules and it can't be done. Her problem cannot be solved.
I think when it comes to innovation, you know, you need that creativity and flexibility because that's the nature of innovation. But I think you do need some process. And what I mean by that is if you genuinely have a problem to solve, you've got to build from a hypothesis that there was a solution out there. So that means that what does good look like in a year's time, 2 years' time, and 5 years' time? And how do you design the conditions of success at the beginning and not after every stage? Because only then can you scale. Building on that further, that means that on day one, when you're looking at that problem, you look in all of your colleagues in the eye that have an interest. So that could be your tech colleagues, because it might be some system integration, might be your HR colleagues, because it could be a business change. It could be your engineering colleagues. It could be your procurement colleagues. It could be many others. And you all look each other in the eyes, are we up for this? And if we are we going to do what we can within our power to make sure it can go through the different stages if it works? And part of that is also now having a conversation around business planning. You have to have that business planning conversation early to say, I'm doing some experimentation here. And in next year's business plan, we may need some money if this creates value. So then you're starting to talk about leadership, which is a chief procurement officer working closely with the service owner, with the finance director, to say, we're trying something new here. And if it works, it might save us some money, or it might create other forms of value. Are we up for that? And I think then start working through that. The next stage then is to go out to the market with the right problem statement. So you're not over-prescribing, nor are you being so vague that you get thousands of random ideas, and seeing what's out there. And then once it's out there, then you need to go out and put the right procurement processes in place. And I can give a couple of examples here where you can use the innovative partnership procedure, which is soon to become the competitive flexible procedure in the new procurement act. And that allows you to do multi-stage elements or include multi-stage elements in one single procurement. And once you've done that and you've done the procurement because it was successful, then you've got to build a business case through that process to say, it was fine doing it on one site. It was also fine doing it on 20 sites. But what about 10,000 sites? And then you start building a business case. And then after you've built the business case and you've done the procurement, then you've got to manage the change side of things, because it could be an operational process change. It could be a business change of some other sorts. And then you've got to do the benefits realization. So suddenly you're in a transformation type program, depending on what you're trying to solve, rather than simply a procurement program. And I think that's how we need to design it, which is really think about those different stages. Think about what success looks like at those different stages. And be prepared to close it down. There were programs within a week we said it won't work for our organization. And that means that the programs that you focus on and the problems you're trying to solve might not always be the really exciting ones from an innovation point of view. Focus on the ones that meet the right criteria up front.
Yeah, and as you say, be willing to stop things as well, which is something that all of us find very, very hard to do. And we find it hard to start. We don't experiment as much as we should do, and we find it hard to stop. We keep running an experiment far longer than we should. All right, let's move on to the Procurement Act. So this is the truly exciting stuff. I'm sure all my listeners are on the edge of their seat getting the opportunity to talk about the new Procurement Act. But nevertheless, this is really important because the public procurement frameworks that have existed for many decades and are heavily embedded into EU law, I think a lot of people would say, are trying to achieve absolutely the right outcomes, removing the possibility of bribery, corruption, all the things that undoubtedly used to happen in the bad old days, but probably now at the expense of enabling the right outcomes to be achieved. The new Procurement Act comes into effect this month. What will change?
Yep. So I think I'll comment on it strongly from an innovation point of view. And I think some of the things that are really relevant here are, firstly, the pipeline transparency is an important point. So people now, if there's a certain spend from a public authority, you have to show your pipeline well in advance. So that allows the market to decide whether they want to bid for stuff or not, which is really good because then people can plan their bidding strategies and processes well in advance. I think the second area is pre-market engagement is now part of a process. It's not a nice to have. You have to start, it has to be part of your procurement process. So that's good because that means that you're looking far and wide rather than not looking at all. And you have to bake time in for that. I think the frameworks will be much more open. The days of those closed frameworks, where people can't onboard, or suppliers can't onboard, it will also be challenged, which is good. There's certainly more openness for startups and SMEs. So there needs to be good reason why they can't bid for a particular procurement, because we've seen some of the SQ stages where startups are already ruled out because of complex insurance cover required or how much revenue they made in the past. I think the one that I'm most interested about is around the competitive flexible procedure. So that allows you to do these multi-stage elements within a single procurement. So it gives you much more flexibility and allows you to test things along the way rather than over-prescribing up front.
Right, let's go through some of those then. So the point around startups being ruled out is something that is a real issue at the moment, isn't it? You've got startups being told that they need to have this particular threshold of insurance, which is completely bonkers for a business of their size. However, if I, you know, bring in a metaphorical finance chief finance officer into this conversation, what they would say is, that's all very well, but we're a public sector organization. We're spending taxpayers' money. We can't take a risk on an organization that might fold, might leave us in the lurch, might not be able to deliver. We need to be able to check that they have delivered the same product five times previously to different satisfied clients, et cetera, et cetera. So how is this resolving the problem that startups are locked out without creating massive new potential for either risk or for new ways of achieving the same goal of locking people who are deemed risky out of the procurement?
So, you know, there are some real knotty problems that need to be solved in the public sector that aren't being solved. And, you know, whether it was in London around air quality and 10,000 people a year dying as a result of respiratory diseases, or over 90 deaths and thousands of serious injuries on the road network, and many other challenges, that means that we have to find new solutions. And that means that if we're having that conversation with a finance director, it's everything we've tried hasn't worked or isn't working at the speed that we need it to work. So we have to try new things. There are examples where this has worked. Network Rail and the Rail Delivery Group. They're working with a company called Transreport, who I was delighted to provide an award to recently. They are now, it's all around accessibility, where people can book and say that I'm turning up on this train, I need some support. And then I'm also getting off on this train at station Y, can someone pick me up? That wasn't available before, so we just ruled out access to a significant audience group on the train service. And what Network Rail did is they tested it. They used a procedure called Contracts for Innovation. So they scaled it to a certain level. It worked, it was proven, and the Rail Delivery Group procured it. So that's one example. Dorset County Council, they've created a testbed for 5G, which looks at challenges around agriculture and various other things. They now have a framework that if there's a good idea, people can onboard on the dynamic purchasing system and scale their ideas. Transport for London, we ran the London Road Lab program using the innovative partnership procedure to reduce the adverse impact of roadworks. And we scaled two solutions after a procedure and awarded a significant value contract. And HS2 are doing the same. They're working with their joint venture partners. And if innovators and startups in particular have good ideas, they're using that mechanism to scale them. So it's happening. We just need to normalize it more and be very balanced when we approach it. Because I'm not saying let's bring a startup in to, you know, to build new rolling stock on the national rail. So there's got to be a degree of balance.
And so what does the Act do differently? Because the examples you gave me there are great examples, but they're by definition things that are already possible. What does the Act change that makes it more accessible to startups without creating significant new risk for the public sector?
So I think it's, rather than it being lots of tenacity and pushing procurement colleagues internally to think about this differently, this is actually saying it should be done. There needs to be more of a level playing field, and it's encouraging that, which I think is great, because that means through pre-market engagement and then the procurement process, it gives better access to startups, and hopefully we'll start seeing more and more startups coming through solving some of those public sector challenges that we have.
And then the open frameworks piece, one of the challenges for smaller businesses is, you know, it can often cost 10, 20 grand's worth of legal fees just to get onto a framework. You've got no idea if you're going to win any work once you're on it. Does this solve the legal costs problem as well as the access problem?
And I think we'll have to wait and see with this one. But I think, of course, there are some frameworks that require complex bidding processes and lots of legal advice. But on the other hand, there are other frameworks that aren't so complicated and large. And my advice to startups would be start with some of the smaller ones first, where you can jump on a DPS before you go with the big ones, and really understand the process, understand what's working for you, and whether you can really, what you don't want to do is get on a framework and never win a contract. So also make sure you're getting onto the frameworks where you've actually got a chance of doing some business.
So tell me about the competitive flexible procedure. I mean, it reminds me slightly of I used to work for a venture capital funded startup, and it kind of reminds me a bit of VC. You know, if you're a VC, what do? You invest a small amount, you set some milestones, you see which of your portfolio businesses achieve those milestones, you invest a bit more, you set some more milestones, you invest a bit more, you set some more milestones, and you keep backing the winners until they scale. Whereas the way we tend to do business cases in corporate, public sector, private sector, corporate, not just a public sector thing, is we tend to judge all the options on Excel, pick one winner there and then, commit all of the investment in one go, and kind of pray that we chose the right one because we're going to build the whole thing no matter what. I think the competitive flexible procedure helps get us slightly more in the sort of think like a VC as opposed to think like a traditional corporate.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the analogy I use is sometimes, you know, when we go out with a procurement, we compare an apple with an apple. and we just focus on cost. And I think we need to get away from that. And I think the new Procurement Act also supports that, which is moving away from the most economically advantageous tender to the most advantageous tender. And I think the competitive flexible procedure is aligned to that spirit. And what it will allow us to do is go out with a problem statement. I think we've always got to be open, transparent and consistent. But it allows us to go out with a particular problem and we have to highlight this different stages. But then you can compare an apple with a banana, with a mango and a pear, you know, right from the outset. So it'd be very different. So one could be an AI solution. The other one could be something physical. The other one could be a data one, et cetera, et cetera. And then what it's allowing you to do is through those different stages, as long as you're consistent with how you're going to measure the different stage gates, it then allows you to measure on outcomes and different forms of value. And that allows you to go through the different stages. And then right at the end, it hopefully allows you to scale. So it's giving you much more flexibility to test, to stop, to continue through one procurement, rather than this frustration, which is any company could be working with a particular public sector agency. You work with them for months and months to prove that your product works. And then the public sector agency says, right, now we have to stop and we have to re-procure. So everyone comes back in. And that feels a bit unfair on an agent or innovator who's allocated a lot of time, effort and budget to work with the public sector to prove it. And then they have to go back out to retest.
So talk me through how this could work in practice. Let me make this up. I'm a highways authority and I want to reduce road deaths. Right. What does this procedure enable me to do that can help me make my city safer?
Yep. So the first thing you would do is you'd put a call out with that problem statement and you set out what the overall spend could be. So it's an up to value. And you go out and scan the market and you encourage the market to respond. And hopefully you might do some pre-market engagement to see what's out there already, or do you genuinely, because there might be another procedure you could use. And then as part of that, you'll get lots of people applying. You then down select as you would do. And then you start the experimentation stage, which is you could say it's 8 companies or it's 7 companies. You know, as long as you've listed that up front, you start the experimentation and you see whether it's working for you or not.
Situation, just to clarify, could I be in a position? So my problem was road deaths. Could I have a situation where one of them's applying some AI to the traffic signals? One of them's got a new road surface that's going to be safer. One of them's got a behavioral science solution that they're going to apply to signboards. Could it be that kind of really diverse problems, solutions to my problem?
Absolutely. And I go back to that analogy of apple, pears, mangoes, bananas. It could be completely very different solutions. So they're not like for like. And that's what you're testing. And that's what they're proving. And I think you go through the different stage gates. So it could be 1 stage gate, 2 stage gates, 5 stage gates, where you're constantly refining and iterating if you need to, because you might not come up with a perfect answer on that first trial. So you allow them some time to tweak it and iterate it. And then you keep on moving forward. And hopefully at the end, you find one, if not more solutions that really adds value that you can directly procure.
And then when I get to the stage of saying, okay, the right thing for me is the AI intervention on traffic signals, what do I then have to do to scale that up across my city?
Yeah, and this is where even the bigger challenge comes in, because I think people think after they've done the procurement, it's the finishing line. And this is where you start bringing in your operational colleagues in highways. You start bringing in your asset managers. Hopefully you brought them in at the beginning. You start bringing in your road safety colleagues and anyone else that has an interest in this particular product. And then you start to implement it. And as you implement it, it will have lots of change processes within your own organization.
But the point is that the framework of the procedure has still got me to the position where I can procure it. I don't have to do another process to procure it for the scale of the city.
Absolutely. And I think that's where the cultural bit and the change bit should be baked in as you design the procurement process. But at the end, absolutely, you can directly procure and scale it.
And so one of the reasons why you talk about the cultural piece with the highways team, for example, is almost when it starts out as a series of 8 experiments, the senior leader who needs to be brought in might not even have kind of realized that at that stage they are also in the process of procuring a scale solution that could be eventually applied across their entire highways estate. Because most people are still in this world of, we have small scale pilots, we have large scale procurements, and they are often run by different teams and they look like very different things. And this brings them all together into one.
Exactly. And this is where I think, you know, heads of innovation are doing a brilliant job because they're trying to drive a change in the business. But sometimes if they're too focused on the technology and whether it works at an R&D stage, there is a danger that you still won't do what you set out to do, which is realize value. And to do that, you have to bring everyone else on side right from the outset. And that might mean the solution could be brilliant and it could add value and you genuinely have tested it technically and it works. But if the organization is not ready for it, you might still not realize that value.
So how much of what we've talked about is made possible by the new Procurement Act?
Yeah, so the competitive flexible procedure and, you know, this most advantageous tender. And also there's a new digital platform now. So going back to your earlier point on startups, what they do, what this digital platform will do now is you register once on a platform rather than having to register every time. So it makes it, again, much easier to bid for procurements or tenders. So I think I'm hoping that we'll start to see value. I think a lot of it is on appetite to risk and change, because as a new act comes in, there are still other traditional processes that people may follow that are really safe and makes it quite hard for an innovator to come through, and you might overprescribe what you want. So I still think, despite the processes perhaps changing and the act encouraging this, if people still in the mindset is got to play it really safe, we're not ready for this, you won't realize the value.
So what I'm hearing, it sounds to me, tell me if I've got this right, it sounds to me like the new act doesn't change that much. It improves what's there now, but the solutions that are available as a result of the act largely were available before if you knew where to find them. And it's kind of a, it's almost like a, how can I put this? It sounds a bit like it's almost a PR job for like the right approaches and the right solutions, more than fundamental new enablers that did not exist last month that become available this month.
I mean, I think it has moved on. But there are. I mean, for example, the innovative partnership procedure was there, as you mentioned. It's a 2015 regulation. So some of it was done. We did it in used it in London. But I also think, it, going off on a slight tangent, it's not just about startups where the innovation comes, because sometimes public sector, when we talk about innovation, it's like it's a tech thing, or it's an engineering thing, or it's a startup thing. And I think what I would encourage every public sector body to think about is you can exchange on data. You can exchange on your subject matter expertise. You can exchange on your brand. You can also exchange on cash, but also land. You know, lots of public agencies own land. So how do you start leveraging that value, whether it's through land? So for example, e-bikes we're seeing across the UK now. What have cities got to offer? They've got lots of land, so they can use their parking bays as an example of an exchange. And hopefully that drives modal shift. Or lots of public sector agencies have land. Yeah, in London, TfL is the third largest landowner. So how can you build joint ventures with the market to be more creative around affordable housing, creating more commercial estates, real estate, and so forth? And also, it's also about working with the corporates. Sunderland City Council are working with Bolden on a 5G partnership for 20 years. And the value that will create for the city is immense through better connectivity and better outcomes for citizens. And in London, we work with Mercedes-Benz around sharing data. And we're looking at risk models in a completely different way based on car skidding, accelerating, et cetera, et cetera. So we're building new forms of risk models. And we've seen it now. It's live in Manchester with the bus franchising model and with the B network, using standards to influence innovation and constantly thinking about what new ideas there are out there. And innovation schedules, we put them in London. If you're buying a lamppost, it'll take you a year or two to procure it. By the time it's gone live, it's already not as innovative as it could be. So how do you start putting in schedules within contracts so you can innovate? So I think, answering your question, there's lots out there. I think we need to normalize it much more by working with the public sector. And that's what IPEC's trying to do. IPEC is either trying to empower through upskilling and embedding resources into local authorities. We're working with the University of Manchester and Birmingham to build the evidence to say, what are the barriers to innovation, but also where is it working well and what value is it creating? We have over 3,000 people in our community, primarily public sector colleagues. They really want to drive value and they really want to use innovation. So how do we tell these stories that actually there are many examples across the UK? Another one that I heard about today, the Atomic Energy Authority, they've created a new testing facility for fusion and they apply the innovative partnership procedure. How do we start talking about these more? And that's what IPEC's trying to do. And I think over time, as more and more examples come through and as we get more and more desperate with our problems, hopefully we work with the market in a completely different way.
Very final question for me. As a public sector manager, is there one thing that will become possible as a result of the Procurement Act next month that wasn't last month?
I'm hoping that as we talk about this more and more, in particular the competitive flexible procedure, colleagues in the public sector start putting their hand up and say, how can I be a bit more entrepreneurial with the market to test some new ideas and new thinking that ultimately can create value for us? Also accepting that some things will inevitably fail, but the ones that succeed overall are providing much more financial value. They're delivering faster policy outcomes, and ultimately it's working better for the citizen. And that's who we're here for.
Rakesh Shah of the Innovation Procurement Empowerment Centre. Thank you very much indeed for joining me on the Freewheeling Podcast.
Thank you, Thomas. It was a pleasure.
Well, thank you very much for joining me for this week's edition of the Freewheeling Podcast. And thank you very much to Rakesh Shah for joining me as well. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and I will be back next week with another guest. So I hope you join me then. Goodbye.